Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Dyed Green. I'm Max Sussman.
And I'm Kate McCabe. We're really excited to kick off the second season of our podcast. And we are a little bit late in starting because, drumroll, we had a baby 8 weeks ago.
Yay.
So her name is Vivienne, and she is doing a guest appearance later in the show. You'll hear some very adorable crying in the background. But don't let it distract you from our special guest.
So we're really happy to be kicking off this season with none other than Kwangi Chan. And after talking to him on our podcast, we only have one question. Is there really anything that he can't do? The Dublin-based chef and cookbook author owns two restaurants, a food truck, a retail sauce company, and regularly appears on TV.
Kwangi was born in Hong Kong and moved to Donegal when he was 8 years old, and he grew up cooking in his uncle's Chinese takeaway.
As an adult, he chose a culinary education over art school and went on to work in a number of Michelin-starred restaurants before going out on his own.
Kwangi's first book, Wok, came out last year and is the first Irish-Chinese cookbook to be published in Ireland.
It was really awesome to talk about Kwangi and to speak about his career trajectory, what Chinese food in Ireland is like, white people cooking Asian food, and, of course, the future of the food industry in the face of a variety of challenges that it's facing today. So without further ado, here's our interview with Kwangi Chan.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, we're happy to have you on the show.
I'm just in my production unit here in Dublin. So this is where I produce my black garlic juice and the sauces and the spices, you know. So it's part of the company with the restaurants that we have on the retail side.
That's awesome. We were going to ask you about that. So it's great that you would just jump right into it. But can you tell us a little bit about the sauce company and how that started and, you know, the products you're making and what the reception has been and what the market's like?
Yeah. So I started a retail sauce company. We started off in sauces about 2015. And it was a hot sauce that I started with. Just after me coming out of my kind of professional career chefing, you know, from Michelin stars. And I said, right, I want to create a sauce and I want to sell it. And I think it was like 30 bottles at the start. And it's like more of a miso kind of spicy hot sauce, like a gochujang kind of base. So we fired it into the local supermarket and got done our own labeling and all that and tested and, you know, begged the manager to take it in, and eventually he did after me hounding him for 5 days, you know. He says, right, we'll put it up the shelf, we'll see how it goes. And I sold maybe 6 bottles in the first month or something like that, or even 13, I can't remember. It was under 20 anyway. So that's the start of it. But now 5 years in, I have about maybe 10 products. I'm after doing a rebrand, so I'm kind of shrinked down again. But we did have 10 products, mostly focused on black garlic. So I ferment our own black garlic now. We're probably one of the biggest suppliers in the black garlic in the country at the moment to food service, restaurants, bar, and also retail. We make a chili oil out of it as well. And sauces. So we want to focus on that. And yeah, so that's what we do. We were in about 850 stores because we did hit the big massive supermarkets, the retailers, you know, like Aldi and Lidl. You probably don't have that over there, but they're all over. Between the two of them and the rest of them, probably 850 stores that we were in the last couple of years. And now after rebrand, I'm just kind of shrink down to kind of refine just a couple of niche kind of suppliers, you know. So, yeah.
When you started off, were you thinking that you'd be making sauces for retail or for restaurants? And how did that whole thing evolve?
I didn't really actually think it would go this far, you know what I mean? Like, so just wanted to make a sauce and put it out there and test because see how it goes, you know? And then all the problems came along and you solve all these problems and then people asking for more and just got bigger and bigger. And we entered a couple of big massive supermarket kind of like enterprise kind of products kind of deals. So it was with Lidl, it was like with Kickstarter. So basically they take products in and they pick like from all the suppliers. I think it was like 500 and something. Like we won that. So I won that contract for a year. With the spice bag seasoning I developed. So basically it's like a hot and chili kind of seasoning that we do with chicken here. It's very popular, the spice bag, you know, chicken. So I made a spice for that. We won the contract for a year and we ended up staying with Lidl for about 5 years. So that was a great contract. And then we won a grow program with the other supermarket with Aldi, and we got a chili Ryu in there for a year, you know, so that kind of all took off and, you know, and that's how it kind of started. But it's not easy. Retail is tough.
So I wanted to take a few steps back and talk about your initial time in Ireland. You moved to Ireland when you were 8 years old from Hong Kong. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your introduction to Irish food. Did you have any expectations about that before you came over, or do you have any specific memories of your initial eating experiences in Donegal?
Yeah, so basically I was born in Hong Kong and I came over here to Ireland when I was 8. My uncle had a Chinese restaurant here. Basically, I was sent over here to because my mother and father had a bad divorce and they couldn't take care of me anymore. My father was supposed to look after me, but he ended up sending me to his brother over here in Donegal in the Chinese restaurants. When I landed here, I didn't have a word of English. So I was learning English. I was going to second primary school, wasn't it? Yeah, primary school. And I was helping out the restaurant like any normal immigrant family does, you know. So you live upstairs and you work on the takeaway downstairs, you know. I'm sure it's the same over in the States, like, you know. So. But that was great. I learned a lot. So I learned how to fry rice and, you know, put on rice and wash, peel the prawns and all that. So just basic stuff at the start. And I ended up basically running the takeaway when I was 13, you know. So I learned how to do all the dishes and do the wok and all that there. So basically I was running the kitchen side of it. And when I first came over, I didn't really, I didn't know what to expect, I suppose. I think my biggest memory was lasagna, chips and coleslaw. I think that was the nicest thing I ever had. It was from a little cafe around the corner that I went down. And I think back then it was only like, I had 5 pence, you know, like a note. That was like an old Irish, currency. And I think it was 5 pence that you can get like a lasagna, chips and a can of Coke, like, you know. So that was like kind of my day out around the corner. So that was my childhood. And I worked all the time in the takeaway and that was it. And I didn't even know that I just kind of interested in the cooking, you know, and just went further then studied. Got a college somewhere else later.
Was there a moment that you knew that you wanted to pursue cooking? Obviously it was something that's kind of was in your background, but more as just something that you did with, you know, as work with your family. But was there a moment where you were like, oh, this is actually something that I can do for me?
Yeah. Cause, I think, there wasn't really anything else to do that I know of, you know, cause I wasn't great at school and, I wasn't, I wasn't good at anything. I was good at art. I know I was very creative, you know, so, and I wanted to put the creativity, I was obviously, went into the cooking, but it didn't really kind of fit the profile because I can do the Asian cooking and all that, but it's not very creative. As in, if you kind of look at the French gastronomy, you know, on the plate, like, you know, it's like art, you know what I mean? It's a bit different than Asian cooking because it's wok cooking. It's a lot different, you know? So I fell into, when I heard that there was I was like doing my leaving cert and I was like, which is, and I was, I didn't know what I was going to do. I did get accepted honors arts, in Derry or somewhere else. And I decided to go cooking because like, I heard the last minute that you can train as a chef. I didn't even know you can study as a chef or you can certify as a chef. So I ended up in Kellybegs in Donegal doing my 3 years, diploma. So, yeah.
So how'd you end up, launching your restaurants from that point? What was that process like for you? Was it a natural journey or was it a rocky journey? Was there a long, were you always certain that that's how you would go or how that, what was that like?
Yeah. So, the restaurant certainly came after I studied, culinary arts in Kellybegs and I'd done my degree later on. So over in that space of time, there was 6 years, you know? So, when I was in college, I kind of got into I was selected for the local, there was these culinary competitions that the schools did and you go all over the country, you know, and, say Dublin, Cork and Belfast and Galway and it's like divided up and I was quite good at the competitions. So I got selected for the Irish team when I was quite young, when I was just finishing the college, you know, and we traveled abroad with that team there, which is the panel of chefs. And we done a lot of competitions and I went to London and I won the Junior Grand Prix when I was like 20 over there. It's called Hotel Olympia, big, massive, huge competition. And it was like a 5-day competition. So I was quite good at that. And I ended up in, I think, winning a silver medal in the Culinary Olympics for cooking. So I went on then and decided that I want to learn kind of hotel. So I was kind of done fine dining and I worked in a few Michelin star restaurants and as you know, and I learned my way and, but I wanted to learn mass production, how the bigger hotels do, you know, volume, like, you know what I mean? Because in my way of thinking was back then was like, if you have a restaurant, I just don't want to go fine dining. I want to learn across the board about catering, you know, I want to learn everything. So I learned, worked in a lot, the one of the biggest hotels for a while in City West and learned mass production, how they got served like 2,500 people out in 45 minutes, you know. So see the production line and, you know, the SOPs and what way to do it. And then after that, I worked for a contract catering company as a development chef for the fine dining area of it. So basically it's going around the law firms and banking, you know, feeding the executives, creating menus and doing private dining there for a while. So the corporate side is it's a minefield, but I think it was great learning in it, you know, how to deal with the, clients, you know, and probably speak that kind of language, you know, in the banking, you know, just learn how to do that because it's quite a lot of paperwork and a lot of emails over and back, you know, so that was quite corporate. And I didn't really like that part of it, but it's nice to see it, you know, but it's funny because now that I'm in my own business, it's all kind of coming back to that, you know. So when I'm looking back, like all the way through my career, it's like I've learned all these different skills to do my own business now, you know, in the way that it's kind of running better, you know. If I hadn't done what I did, like working the hotels, working the contract catering, and I probably wouldn't have been able to run my own business as good as it is today, you know? So I think it's valuable. Yeah, it's valuable for a chef to kind of learn all the trade for the hotel.
Yeah. I think a lot of people like go into, a lot of chefs spend their whole life, you know, cooking in different restaurants. And then all of a sudden they're like, now I'm ready to open my own restaurant. And then they realize they don't know half of it or even more than half of what there is to actually running the business. So do you think you're saying you got a lot of that sort of experience from the varied types of jobs that you had that weren't just necessarily focusing on only culinary technique.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's not just like I was, I think the last serious job and the chefing wise before I went to all that was I went back to, you know, do, I was a head chef in a Michelin star restaurant for 4.5 years in the Cliff House Hotel and under a Dutch Michelin star chef, you know, so basically I was running the kitchen from, and you know, we got 4A rosettes and we achieved a lot there, you know, in 4 years. And then I went up back in Dublin and opened this new concept and more like an Asian kind of tapas, kind of bar disco concept. I wanted to open kind of like a nightclub with a tapas kind of Asian style, you know, which is quite popular at the time because I was looking over London, I was looking over Hong Kong and this kind of style. But I still think that it was called Soda & Co. It was quite early at this time. But, you know, that was back in 2015. So I think Dublin wasn't kind of ready for that. So it went quite well for the first year and decided this is not what I want to do, you know. So and then I went out on my own then, really. So that's how it kind of all started.
I have a question about your style of cooking. The very first time that I ate at a Chinese takeaway in Ireland was in Belfast, and someone that I was with ordered fried rice with gravy on top, which is something that you certainly wouldn't find at a Chinese restaurant in the US, really anywhere. And I noticed when the cookbook that you published with Blasta Books, Wok, came out, a lot of the news articles said it was the first Irish Chinese cookbook to be published in Ireland. And so I was just curious, is there something particular about this type of food that you make that distinguishes it from Chinese food? Is there something particularly Irish other than, you know, the produce and ingredients that you use that differentiates your food from, you know, maybe somebody else's who's not Irish?
So, so my style, when I went into my first restaurant, it was actually called Bowls, and I traveled to Hong Kong quite a lot because I work with the Irish food board a lot, Board Bia, and I've done a lot with the consulate in Hong Kong promoting Irish beef. And I used to travel over back 3 or 4 times a year, just doing activations for different types of companies. And when I was over there, Hong Kong is quite of a melting pot anyway, because of the English colonized influence. So it's not like, it's more of a fusion, really, if you really want to think about it. And I kind of brought that back over into Ireland. And my first restaurant was called Bowls. And it's kind of like a version of a cha-cha tang, which is kind of like it's like a cart noodle kind of place. You can really kind of go in, pick a bowl, and there's, you know, you pick a rice noodles or whatever, and then you pick all your toppings, your meat, and then your toppings. But all my vegetables were fermented, fresh kind of avocado, and, you know, we use a load of fresh, nice kind of produce every day, you know. And that kind of went okay, but I think it was that kind of hit in the COVID, and that kind of didn't work because my food is not kind of, I grew up in a Chinese takeaway, but my food is not takeaway food. It's more of a fusion Irish mixed in together. So when COVID hit, I decided, right, okay, we need to get a food truck. Okay. So, and from the food truck, I says, right, we need to create some kind of street food, kind of easy to eat. So one hander or, you know, something that you can grab your hands and eat, you know, because it's all going to be takeaway and coming from a food truck. So I bought this 20-foot food truck, and it took about 3 months to clean up. It was really bad. And then we spent quite a bit of money on it and brought it out, got it wrapped and all. And so we have created like a spice bag kind of bao. So if you think like a char siu bao, which is a bao with a char siu in the middle of it, is quite popular in the dim sum kind of world. So we have this Korean kind of bao, which is the hargao bao, which is like a clamshell kind of bao, which we put a spice bag kind of salt and chili chicken in it. We've done kind of like Asian style tacos. We done like Korean chili burgers. So we done a lot of that kind of, you know, bits and pieces. And we're big into dumplings as well, like a Szechuan style kind of dumplings. So we do that kind of fusion stuff because I want to kind of stay away that, you know, that not all Chinese is meant to be like gravy and rice, you know. So I think that's kind of like an 80s kind of version of a Chinese takeaway. So yeah, so it's nice to see a change into how kind of Asian food has evolved since my time in the late 80s or to now, like, you know what I mean? And with the book Wok that we brought out, it was all kind of like the classics that I wanted to put in there, because like it's all the sweet and sour and, you know, the food that I really loved when I was a child and that I can cook. And also some of the dishes that I kind of traveled to Hong Kong and taste the flavors, and I came back and kind of incorporated that flavors and the Irish ingredients and that, you know. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about like what you just mentioned about the evolution of the food since the 80s? I'm really curious about what that path has taken, and like, you know, I'm really interested in how that has sort of mirrored like maybe cultural changes in Ireland too. Like, has the food changed because of other changes that are also happening? What's your take on that?
My take on, okay, so basically since the 80s when I came in, it was all Chinese takeaways. And the Chinese takeaways, we do like curry beef and satay beef and black bean sauce. I'm sure it's the same across the world, you know. Different versions of it. So you
pretty have, similar.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it was a model that was made up by an American Chinese chef, and it kind of eventually rolled out to all the immigrants and say, look, you can actually make a living with this, you know what I mean? So this is the kind of menu you do, and this is what you do. And it was kind of like a recipe for success, you know what I mean? And everybody kind of followed that. But as generations grow along, especially for me, I'm not sure if I'm the second generation or the first generation. No, I'm the second generation. So second generation Chinese normally be pushing to, okay, you're going to go and study law, or you're going to go and study, you know, you're going to be a doctor or whatever. Because obviously our parents and didn't work that hard for us to go and take over the takeaway. So most of the Chinese takeaway kind of closed down, or they kind of deteriorated, because the older generation would have traveled back to Hong Kong, or they made their money and they've gone back to China or Hong Kong, wherever it is. So the second generation that kind of left with the Chinese takeaway, or they're still in the food business, would have changed the model to more of a street food kind of vibe around it, you know. So they'll start doing like, I don't know, like if you want to see the momofukus, or you know, that kind of change, like, you know, into ramen noodles, and they do like you know, like the tacos, or they do like a, you know, the Korean kind of, you know, kebab, or, you know, they want to change because they don't want to stay in the same old model again. I think Ireland is going through that at the moment. Back in the 2015 when I opened up the Asian fusion kind of concept, there wasn't that many Asian concepts around. I think there was maybe, there wasn't even a ramen shop at the time. I think that only came after. And I opened my restaurants, Bowls. I think there was a couple of traditional kind of stuff like hot pot and really kind of dirty kind of, you know, places that you go into, you know. And I was thinking, right, there has to be some different way to doing this. Like, you know, I think there was one or two really good places, but it wasn't enough. Now the city is really, I think it's 2023. So it was like over a space of like 6 years, Dublin has, you know, jumped in huge amount of Asian style restaurants and all that out. And I think it's because, you know, the influence, I'm not going to say that I influence a lot of people, but I think I kind of give a lot of the Chinese kind of community that's still in restaurants to rethink that, you know, the old takeaway style doesn't have to be a dirty counter or a really kind of less place. We can do it up nicely and do up nice food, and maybe we can charge a bit more for food, you know what I mean? Because I hate the way that Chinese food is always looked as a cheap, you know what I mean, that it's a cheap kind of version of food, like, you know what I mean? And that you think of going in and eating like a sushi or Korean, you can charge a lot more. That's, you know, that's terrible. Like, you know, way of thinking, like, you know. And I always say that to people, it's like, okay, close your eyes and think of a Japanese kind of kitchen, you know, and what do you think? Like, you know what I mean? So it's always nice and silent and, you know, really skillful and peaceful. And if you close your eyes and think about a Chinese kitchen, you know, it's like, you know, noise everywhere, everybody's shouting, you know, and, you know, walks kind of flaming everywhere. It's really noisy. So that's the kind of perception that people have in their mind anyway, you know. So it's kind of like Chinese food is cheap. And because I wanted to change that. And now that I think a lot of shops across the city, we have a couple of bao places. We have a couple of Korean chicken places. We have a really good Asian fusion of two or three kind of dumpling kind of places now, you know, serving really nice food. I think we are going the really right way about it, you know. So I think the evolution of Asian food has changed so much in Ireland. I think a lot of people have traveled as well a lot and came back, and that's what they kind of want, you know. So
that's really cool. You see that similar process happening around like other types of food? I mean, I'll just like in the States, like that conversation is really prevalent in terms of like, oh, why do we expect certain types of food to have to be less expensive than other types of food, you know? So yeah, I think that story is like really familiar.
Yeah, it's so funny, you know, because you're using the same ingredients and it's just different style of cooking, and you're using different spices, and we have to charge less because it's Chinese, you know, than Italian or
right.
You know,
exactly. But it's like, well, it's not like it takes less work.
Exactly.
It takes less effort to make the food. It takes the same amount, if not, you know.
I'm curious when you talk about the proliferation of Asian restaurants in the city and maybe across mm-hmm. Ireland, are some of those restaurants, or it's my understanding that some of those restaurants have white people at the helm rather than people of Asian descent. And in the United States, it's pretty controversial.
Yes.
People talk a lot about cultural appropriation. And it seems like, although I have seen some critiques of that in Ireland, it seems like the environment is much less critical of, you know, white Irish people opening Asian restaurants. Can you comment on that? Is that true? Is that something that you like? Do you think there's less of a stigma attached to it in Ireland?
No, not at all. I think there is less of a stigma. And I know that, there was a couple of places that opened and wasn't very good. And compared to the Asian places that I know, and they got great reviews, you know what I mean, from one of the top critics. And I did have something to say about that at the time. And I just feel like, sure, what's the point, you know what I mean? It's not okay to, you know, that a Chinese chef is cooking away at his traditional kind of food down the other side of town, and because the service wasn't the same, or, you know, because the plates weren't as nice and you weren't served the proper way that you're normally kind of served in the European kind of restaurant, you know. It doesn't mean that the food isn't good, you know. So, and the food wasn't that great either from that review, but she gave a rave review. So, look, so if the Asian kind of chef tries and does something really good, it's like, oh, it's not as good, you know. But if it's kind of like a white kind of chef, you know, and an Irish chef trying to do it, and, you know, oh, it's great, you know. So, I don't know if it's the same over on your side of the world, but we did have some of that. But now it's kind of really good. I think they have really upped their game a lot, you know. So, and I think, you know, if people kind of cook the right food and use the right ingredients, I suppose, you know, race doesn't really come into it. Like, it's just that I think for critics, they need to look across the board, you know what I mean? And look at what the Chinese chefs are doing over the other side, and, you know, and this is the way we eat in our culture, you know. So
right, it's interesting that like a critic that doesn't necessarily have that as their background is the one who gets to comment on whether it's a quote-unquote good restaurant or not, when there's obviously a lot of different ways to experience good food. And it sort of ties into what you were just talking about in terms of what you can get away with charging for the food as well. Cause I would imagine that maybe some of those restaurants had a higher price point, and it was like,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah,
no one's absolutely really saying that it's too expensive for them to do it. But then when you try to do it, it's like, you know, more pushback.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Yeah. So look, that's the way it is, you know, and you kind of get used to that over the years because that's the way it is. And you're just trying to try harder, you know, but I'm quite happy where I am at the moment, what we're doing. We have a good following and, you know, we do Asian and Irish kind of fusion kind of food. Not at the higher ends. That's not where we're at. We're at the middle kind of market and we like to feed everybody, you know, so, and people like our food and that's the way I like it, you know, so there's no, I hate the word, you know, like food divided into categories, like, you know what I mean? That you have to be judged in a certain way because you're cooking a lower type of food, you know what I mean? So I'm kind of got away from that over the years, you know, so yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So, all right. So you have a restaurant, a food truck, a sauce company, and now a cookbook.
And television.
And what are we missing? And what is, like, what are you going to do next? Because that's such an incredible array of areas to tackle.
Yeah. So basically we have a food truck in there, which opens, you know, in seasonal, over in Malahide, which is kind of like a marina kind of seaside town, which is great. I love that. My staff love going out there in the summer. It's a different vibe altogether. It's nice for them to get out of the kitchen as well. They're kind of stuck in there for the rest of the year, you know. Capital Dock Restaurant is a big, huge 100-seater restaurant, which we have a wine bar kind of attached to it. That's going really well. And we do a great, we also have a Camden Street kind of takeaway and kind of hop in and hop out. Because when I was in Hong Kong and, you know, there's not that many really big restaurants. It's all kind of like really fast. Kind of you hop on and you sit and eat your noodles and you're away again. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be like a, you know, nice kind of chandeliers hanging or whatever, you know? So that's kind of like Camden Street was that kind of place for that. And also my thinking was that I need somewhere else to service a bigger delivery kind of coverage in that area in the right center of the town. So for the deliveries and that. So that's going really well. The retail, we just have to go for a rebrand. Was Chan Chan. It's now called East. And we're going to focus a lot on the black garlic. And then the book, hopefully, with Kristen, with the walk. I'm so honored in a way that it's the first Irish-Asian cookbook that I'd be able to do it, you know. So I'm quite humbled in that way that I got an opportunity to represent this side of the culture, you know, being the first Irish Chinese cookbook to be published in Ireland. And hopefully that I'll have another kind of cookbook out, not maybe towards the takeaway, but maybe towards something else different, you know, that all my travels to Hong Kong and we kind of do cover maybe street food more, you know. So, yeah, and also the TV stuff, yeah, and the ambassadorships and stuff like that. So we do a lot of Virgin Media TV, which I do a cookery show called 6 o'clock Show. And I've been doing that for the last 8 years, you know, so that's really good. And I don't know. So we're just at the moment, I'm just trying to tie all that together, you know, so it's quite hard.
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. But a lot of people say, oh, how do you do it? It's funny because like it's all connected together. So when you're working on one thing, it kind of connects to the other. So, you know, the retail kind of connects with the restaurant and you kind of work around. But I also have I don't do it myself. I have a great team on board and I have about 15 people behind me, you know. So that's it. We're like a family, you know, so it's great. A lot of guys were with me for a long time. And yeah, so it's a nice environment to be in. And coming into work, it's not like work at all, you know, so it's great. So yeah, I'm quite happy with that, you know. So,
you know, something we hear a lot about was sort of an evolution of how restaurants are functioning after the pandemic, and, you know, being increasingly difficult to get staff. A lot of people haven't decided to like leave the restaurant industry, or don't really want to come back to it after having not, you know, spent a lot of time outside of working in restaurants. And then also all the challenges due to increasing rents and energy prices. Has the fact that you have projects in food in a lot of different, in non-restaurant areas as well as restaurants, has that made it easier for you to keep your business going and to keep staff around and to keep people happy?
Yeah, so during the pandemic there, so we got a food trailer, but with the retail business as well, we've done a lot of meal kits. So that kind of kept us going for a while. We've done a really good dumpling meal kit, you know. And coming back to think of it, if I didn't have that kind of retail kind of background, I probably wouldn't be able to do a meal kit as good as that. So so from that experience, we kind of put that into a really good dumpling meal kit that we sold about maybe, probably sold about maybe 6,000 or something like that, you know, over the space of COVID. And that kept us going. And that kept the staff busy as well, and with the truck as well. So it was good in that way. The retail side kind of boomed as well during COVID. So that kind of helped me as well to keep above water. So yeah, so I think the restaurant model business has changed so much over the years. I don't think you can just have a restaurant anymore unless you're a really good restaurant, you know what I mean? Like the 3 stars and, you know what I mean? That's, you're full every night and you're booked out every night. I think for restaurants to kind of like really achieve, you have to have different outlets, you know? So you have to have a book, you have to have some retail products to go along with it. You probably have to do a lot of social media, create some YouTube kind of videos, or, you know, your social media has to be really good as well. I think the restaurant business is so broad now, it's more like a marketing company, you know? So you're basically a marketing company selling products, you know? So that's what I'm kind of aiming at in the next couple of years, you know? And that's what we're focusing on. I think that's, the restaurant business has changed so much, you know? So basically you're a marketing company that sells food and retail and other bits and pieces. And staffing is a real issue. I don't know how that's going to go, you know, and it's just the way it is. Maybe tech will change, you know, tech will change our industry in the long run. I don't know how, you know, but I'm always looking at the fast food companies like McDonald's and, you know, the Taco Bells in America, and how they're going to improve, and, you know, to not autonomous kind of food coming out now and all that. And like, I kind of look in that side of food, you know, and how is that going to affect the middle market and the higher end market in the end, you know what I mean? So yeah, so it's a funny world, you know. So it's a tough world to be in at the moment, because if you think of Amazon years ago selling books and they're kind of covering everything, so is that going to just kill all the restaurants in the future, you know? It's a tough kind of way of thinking how food is going to end in 10 years time.
Yeah, I mean, looking at all the, you know, there's like been a run of restaurants closing in Ireland that have one, you know, they're single location restaurants, and obviously they're not as profitable as they needed to be to keep it going. And they didn't really have anywhere else to turn in terms of like the sort of other business outlets, like the way you were talking about it, seeing the restaurants as like a marketing for other food projects. So
yeah, I think that has a lot to do with I think the business model has changed, you know, since about 10 years ago. So
well, it seems like you're on your path to figuring out, or at least sort of on the front edge of figuring it out.
Yeah, it's quite hard. You just have to see, just keep updated all the time and just see where the business is moving to, you know, because it's quite tough out there at the moment. There is a lot of restaurant closing, and with inflation, it's quite hard, you know, because inflation doesn't just affect outside, but it affects our staff as well. So staff are looking for more pay rises because they can't pay the rent, you know, so, and you have to look after your staff. So there's no point in your staff working two jobs, you know, and they can work one job with you, you know, trying to fill that. So you have to make sure that they get paid very well. They live a living that, you know, it's a good lifestyle for them to work in that industry. And I think we do that quite well, you know, and we treat our staff quite well in my company. So a lot of the guys have been with me for years, you know, so it's good. It's quite of a hard balance because obviously a restaurant needs to make profit as well. Well, I was thinking that the change from COVID to now is that you have to work twice as hard to make a euro now than you used to, you know. So that's the way I think about it now, you know. So you have to have different outlets to kind of topple that up, you know what I mean? So because there's only so many people that eat, you know, in certain occasions, especially when the times that people are trying to cut down as well on their expenditure. And food is the first thing they go, you know. So, yeah.
I did want to ask a little bit about the book a little bit more. What's the reception been like? And are you going out and doing events? And like, what's been the experience of writing the book and having it come out now? So, and congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah. So as I said, like I was very honored and being able to do the first Irish Asian cookbook, you know, so with Christian Jensen from Nine Bean Rose and Blaster Books. Did you just get a copy, guys? Did you, or yeah?
Oh yeah, yeah, we have it. Yeah,
excellent. Yeah, I hope you like it. I know it's quite a simple book, but it was designed for the home cook, and it's funny because writing the book it took me a while, you know, because it was just it's not something that any chef is used to writing a book, you know. So it's like right, okay, and especially you're not very good at you know, grammar and stuff like that, so. Christian and done a great job, you know, on the book, and fantastic. And the reception has been really good because it's been a series of books. So we're quite lucky to get involved with some of the colleagues that I know in the industry that has the opportunity to do their book as well. So it was great. We all get the opportunity to do that at the one time. So, and Christian rang me, when I was actually during COVID and I was doing a delivery for the meal kits at the time. And I got this phone call and I was like, hey, do you want to do a book? I was like, yeah, okay. I was like, yeah. And she was telling me about the Kickstart and, you know, I'm going to get people to fund it. And it's a different way of cooking, you know, because I've been trying to get a book out for years and nobody take me on because obviously you don't fit the bracket to be for the big publishers to take you on because you don't have enough following or you're not cooking the right food or, you know, the recipes are, you know, not for the home and you're not, I understand that there's a risk for them for making a loss. Like obviously the book companies need to make money as well. So they always go for the sure thing, you know, but what Kristen did was give the smaller guys an opportunity to have a voice. And I think that's brilliant, you know, because I think that's what Ireland needs at the moment. And also what that creates is variety and, you know, opportunity in the market for, people like myself, you know, that probably doesn't fit the bracket or that people probably wouldn't be looking at for a cookbook, you know, home. So, no, it's a great opportunity to do that kind of food. And also what I want, when we thought about it first, it was like, I had a really kind of complicated kind of book out. I had like a lovely steamed fish. I wanted to do like a really kind of traditional Asian kind of stuff. For being a chef, you know, I wanted to put my best foot forward, you know. And I was like, no, I think the recipes are too hard. I think nobody can make them, you know. And I said, okay, right, what are we going to do? You know, and then I thought about it for ages and ages. And I said, look, why don't I just go back to my roots? Everybody loves Chinese takeaway food. Why don't we do a really good Chinese takeaway food recipes from my childhood and, you know, from my experience, like I said, and then we go from there. So your first book, you know, if you get a following in the first book, you might get a really good following, somebody, the opportunity, or even a chance that somebody might buy your second book, you know, because of your first book. So that's why I was thinking that let's go back to the classics because everybody loves the classics, especially in Ireland. I think a lot of people grew up with the Chinese takeaway. And when my friends go to Australia and they come back, they always want to have a Chinese takeaway because that's what they're used to, you know. It's more like a memory for them, you know. So that's what we did. And the book has done really well. We won the best cookbook of the year, I think it was, as a collective. And
congratulations.
Yeah, and also won the cookbook awards, is it? I think it was we won the best Irish Asian cookbook. The World Cookbook Awards, is it? Or something like that. So yeah, World Food Gourmet Food Book Awards. That's what it was, yeah. And yeah, so that's good. So we're delighted with that.
Yeah, we've loved to see your book and every book in the series. I think it's such a cool way to introduce people to food that, I mean, the whole point of buying a cookbook is you want to learn how to cook something that you don't know how to cook already. But, you know, sometimes a big, heavy, glossy, photographed book can be really intimidating. And I love how these are really approachable ways to get into a new thing for people. And I think that's just, you know, a lot of times the publisher will be like, all right, this, we got to, you know, we got to make it worth it. So we got to make, you know, there has to be like 100 recipes in here and tons of photography, but then it sets it as like something that not everybody can afford to buy. And then not something that people choose to use on a regular basis. So I love that they're just kind of more, I don't know.
Approachable.
Approachable.
Yeah, it's very approachable. And, you know, the artwork is brilliant. It's more like a, what I think, when I pick up the books now and look at it, it's like getting a lot of creative people together and let's do a book, you know what I mean? From writing to, you know, the recipes, from the drawings and from the design of the book, like, you know what I mean? It's such a, you know, a mixing pot of, you know, artistic kind of, you know, collaborations all come in the one, you know, and I think it's a class, you know what I mean? So it's really, really good. Yeah.
We had Kristen on the podcast kind of early on. We also had Lily on and Jess, I guess. We're obviously big fans of Blasta, but Kristen's approach to that series kind of mirrors the way that we see Irish food also. Because, you know, people in the States, when they think about Irish food, they think about like potatoes and Guinness. Yeah. And we think, you know, that some of the most exciting people working in food in Ireland are immigrants and are people that are cooking their home cuisines using like the best Irish produce. And it makes for just these really exciting experiences that people definitely don't expect if they've never been to Ireland before. Or if they go to Ireland, which a lot of Americans do, and they only eat in pubs.
Now, there's some really good food in Ireland at the moment. And it's very interesting that, you know, what's happening in Ireland with all the food and the immigrants, as you're saying, opening up restaurants and opening food businesses and bringing their culture. Like when I go out, I don't go out. Like I love fancy food. That's my background, you know. I love the Michelin stars and stuff like that. But there's nothing stopping me than going down a little side street, like, and, you know, hunting the little families that are cooking their own food, you know what I mean? That has been passed down, recipes has been passed down for a couple of generations, and this is what they cook, you know what I mean? Like, I love that, you know what I mean? I love finding stuff like that and going and trying little small family businesses and tasting that kind of flavors, you know? Because that's soul, you know? That's where food is, you know what I mean? So it's not like recipes has been passed down from, you know, an encyclopedia for years and, you know, you make the same jus and you make the same butter sauce, you know what I mean? It's going around tasting stuff that's different. It's like when you're traveling, you know? And then you have the perception of the flavor that you want to, oh, that's really nice. I can incorporate that into something, you know? Or can I make that into, you know, put that with a different ingredient or, you know what I mean? You know, how can I adapt that flavor and add it into like an Asian spice or something like that, you know? I love that, you know? So, yeah.
Well, before we go, is there anywhere in particular you want to share where you've had like a good, maybe good and surprising food experience that you can let people know about? Shout out some of those smaller, maybe more family-owned places. Is there anywhere that comes to mind?
Yeah, I love Parnell Street in Dublin. I think there's some really good kind of places down there. There's kind of like a good hot pot place. I think there could be a better hot pot place in Dublin. They're all using quite cheap ingredients, but I love to see a really higher end kind of hot pot places like Hong Kong has. obviously, like they need the customer base to pay for it. I think there's a market there for it. There's lovely roast duck places opening up now. Duck in Jury Street. I think Lao. There's a place called Charming Noodles that's doing lovely pull noodles as well by hand. That's really good as well. I pop in there now and again. You know, Big Fan Bao, I think, is really good as well. They do nice kind of fusion food. And I think they're going the right way. Copying, it's kind of like bringing that kind of Hong Kong kind of concept in, you know, of fusion. Obviously, my own restaurant, Bites, as well. Bites, you know, the guys down there are doing a lot of rice bowls. And we do a lot of street food, kind of adaptation from Irish to, you know, Hong Kong kind of influence. I love tacos. Tacos is great. There's a really good food, Alamengro. And I love tacos. They do kind of real traditional kind of tacos are really nice as well. There is a lot of places up and running. And I think I'm so looking forward to the next 5 years and see what comes in, you know. So
That's great. We love to hear it.
Yeah. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for chatting with us today. What a great conversation.
And congratulations on the baby.
Dyed Green is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Dyed Green is a project of Bog and Thunder, whose mission is to highlight the best of Irish food and culture through food tours, events, and media. Find out more at bogandthunder.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have any story suggestions, questions, or things you'd like to share in response to our broadcast, you can email us directly at dyedgreen@heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.